Hey everybody, welcome to the Healthy Skeptic Podcast. This is Chris Kresser, and I'm here with Dr. Emily Deans from the blog Evolutionary Psychiatry, and we're going to talk about the role of nutrition in mental health. So welcome to the show, Emily.
Thanks so much.
So why don't, before we get into the questions, we've got some really great questions that I'm excited to talk about. But before we get into that, I'm really curious to know more about your story, like how you became an evolutionary psychiatrist, because it's certainly not the typical career path for a psychiatrist. And so I'm sure some of my listeners would love to hear a little bit about that too.
Oh gosh, well, you know, it all starts with vanity, probably, if I really have to get down to it. I mean, I've been interested in nutrition and sort of optimal health my entire career. You know, had always sort of followed the USDA and all those recommendations and worked out quite a lot and tried to be healthy. It took an awful lot of work to stay in the same gene size, I have to say, all those years. And then about in 2007, I read, right when it came out, I read Good Calories, Bad Calories. I read all of the Michael Pollan books. And I sort of figured out, whoa, you know, something's really wrong here. And then I started having kids. As you're well aware of, Chris, everything sort of turns upside down when you're pregnant. Or at least your wife is well aware of, anyway.
We both are at this point.
Right. And it was very interesting because while, you know, I'd worked really hard to kind of keep to a very normal weight before, you know, the hormones were everything, and I ate real food. I ate the Michael Pollan food. I didn't eat vegetable oils. I was keeping it to whole grains. And for each pregnancy, I had two in 3 years, I gained 75 pounds. And in between the first and the second, I was able to lose, it was actually quite remarkable. I lost 49 pounds in 49 days after the first one. And
wow.
And eventually got down to all but 5 pounds lost before the second one. But it was still, it was, so that really, really sort of set things in stone that this, that weight gain is hormonal, that, you know, calories in, calories out, and calculating everything and putting it all on fit day and working out enough probably wasn't going to do it, that it all had to do with something with a set point and how things were directing your metabolism. And so after I finished breastfeeding the first one, I thought, you know, I still have, you know, some pounds to lose before I get back to my pre-pregnancy weight. And so I consulted with a paleo sort of, paleo-style nutritionist, and it worked very rapidly and very well, faster than anything that I'd done in the past to kind of maintain my weight. And at that point, I thought, whoa, you know, if, and reading into it in Food and Western Disease and Mark Sisson and Stefan Guyanet's blog, you know, I decided, you know, this has got to be, you know, really important with respect to mental health. What has been looked into this with respect to depression and bipolar disorder and behavior? And so I thought I couldn't really find that much on that. So I decided, well, you know, how many psychiatrists are there who have an evolutionary perspective and, you know, had some anthropology and nutrition training in college? Not too many, probably. So I started my blog, and, you know, a year later, here I am.
That's a great question you posed. How many are there? Do you know of any other folks out there that are approaching things in a similar way at this point, now that you've started doing it? Have you been contacted by anybody in your profession?
Well, there's a psychologist in Oregon, Ann Childers, who's been interviewed by Jimmy Moore. She's kind of a low carb, and she has a Twitter. She's on Twitter, but she's in Oregon, so we have the coast covered. And my, you know, the people in my, I work with four other psychiatrists, and, you know, they're all very excited. And also, I, you know, several other psychiatrists I know from practice all think it's very, very interesting, partly because our major treatments for mental illness aren't particularly good.
Right.
We have therapy and we have, you know, the medications, and they're both, you know, probably about 60% effective. So most psychiatrists really want to help people. They're doctors. They want to, they got into it. They really want to make people feel better. And so, you know, everyone's interested in kind of a new angle and a new idea. So I actually have a lot of people interested in this. I don't know if they're all full bore into it like I am, you know, living it, but they're definitely interested.
Well, that's great. I mean, it's good just to know that there is some interest, and I imagine it's going to take a long time to change the paradigm. And of course, we're fighting against some pretty powerful interests.
Well, that help I mean, to define I have to that say, paradigm. My sort of one of my gurus in medical school, a professor in psychiatry at Harvard, and there are not that many of them. He was very excited about it, more really about the whole Western medicine thing and the Katavans necessarily than psychiatry itself, because there wasn't as much data. Mm-hmm. But he thought it was just fascinating and great. And but another sort of psychiatrist guru was said, you know, I'm skeptical. And that's because it's pretty well established that stress plus genes causes a lot of the mental illness. So it's hard to kind of imagine that our diets also are part of that stress. But, you know, if you have an open mind, I think it's pretty easy to take it all in.
Yeah, I agree. So let's dive in. We've got some great questions, some from your blog and mine and Facebook page. So the first one is from Daria. I think that's how you pronounce her name. And she said, she asked, I'd love for Emily to talk about Alzheimer's if possible and any links to diet and nutrition. My mother's been diagnosed with Alzheimer's and she's been a vegan for years. So what do you say about that, Emily?
Well, you know, Alzheimer's is pretty overwhelming looking at the literature and pretty complicated. It's gotten probably a lot more money, I would say, than some of the other psychiatric diagnoses. So there are more papers, which isn't always a good thing. And a lot of the papers are biased in favor of the lipid hypothesis. So you sort of really have to look at the papers with a skeptical eye before you can make any sort of sense of them. But when it really comes down to it, probably the most brilliant paper that's come out was very recent in the European Journal of Internal Medicine. It was actually by an engineer, Stephanie Sinoff, and some of her buddies who review the literature. And, you know, basically Alzheimer's is a disorder of pathogens, inflammation, and problems with fats in the brain. And what you really need is more fat in the brain, and you need efficient mitochondria, and you need a lack of inflammation. And in order to do that, you really, in my opinion, you know, it isn't, you know, it isn't very well proven in a randomized controlled trial or anything, but you really need to be eating sort of a paleolithic, I would say, you know, if you're that far advanced, a very high fat diet, a ketogenic diet, to really get through the rigors of Alzheimer's. And to prevent Alzheimer's, I would say you really need to be doing a nutrient-rich diet with plenty of omega-3, plenty of magnesium, non-toxic, to avoid inflammation. And I think there's actually quite a lot of evidence that direction. It just really hasn't been put all together except by Stephanie Sinoff, the medical literature.
Yeah, and it you know, you mentioned the ketogenic diet. I've seen some pretty interesting papers on ketogenic diet as a potential treatment for Alzheimer's. And, I mean, for me, if it were myself or someone in my family, I would absolutely want to try that before some of the other pharmaceutical alternatives, because there's, as most people know, really no treatment that is working very well at this point.
Yeah, I mean, there are three or four acetylcholinesterase inhibitors that are FDA approved, but they don't work that great. And one of them, Namenda, I've used a couple times. It's always made everybody worse. So so I've kind of backed off of that one. Aricept is sort of the old-fashioned one, and it can kind of hold people in line for a little while, but it's not great. You know, it's not a cure or really anything corrective by any means. So, you know, if I had, you know, if my parents were diagnosed with dementia, I'd be out there with the coconut oil and and restricting their carbohydrates, partly because it seems very clear that it's part of the disorder is due to energy metabolism in the brain.
Right.
And when you use a ketogenic diet in the brain, you bypass one of the sort of hurdles into getting efficient energy metabolism in the brain. You skip an entire complex in the mitochondria. So your mitochondria, for the most part, are much happier and burning more efficiently if you burn ketones instead of glucose. So it seems like a no-brainer if you have, you know, cognitive impairment or Alzheimer's to at least give that a try. And then to avoid developing it in the first place, you really, you know, it's a disease of inflammation, of hyperglycemia. So you really need to kind of avoid all of those diseases of Western civilization, all of which can be avoided if you really follow sort of a paleo diet and lifestyle for as long as you possibly can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I suspect, you know, as you said, that a large portion of the brain is the dry matter of the brain is lipid, and DHA is especially important. And if you've been a vegan for years and years, you almost certainly aren't eating any, you know, Daria's mom certainly hasn't had much DHA unless she's taking algae supplements, which very few people do.
Right, and there's actually a very interesting component with respect to the plaques in DHA, in that the amyloid precursor protein sort of lines up to be cut, and it can be cut into a way that doesn't make plaque, or it can be cut in a way that makes the plaque that builds up in Alzheimer's disease. And if you have a brain that's, you know, full of plenty of DHA, and literally you need a lot of DHA in the brain, it's something like 20 to 30% of your brain lipids. I mean, it's more than you would expect.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have the omega-3 there, and you replace it instead with omega-6 or something else, things aren't lined up correctly in the lipid rafts and how things are supposed to be. And the amyloid precursor protein is actually cleaved differently. And so that's part of why I object to there's sort of a simplistic classification of Alzheimer's as type 3 diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
And while hyperglycemia, I think, definitely can increase the risk for having it and maybe part of what you have to have to develop Alzheimer's, it's not the entire story.
Right.
And I think being low in omega-3 is also a very disastrous thing for your brain.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, these mechanisms are all connected. So you have high blood sugar and omega-6-3 balance that's out of whack, both contribute to inflammation, which we know contributes to Alzheimer's. So it's a bunch of vicious cycles, it seems like, you know, acting on each other.
Yeah. Yep.
So what about this, you know, a lot of elderly people, of course, as they get older, as soon as their cholesterol goes over 200, they get prescribed a statin, which, you know, in a lot of cases will bring their cholesterol down even below 150. So what about this connection, this possible connection between low cholesterol and Alzheimer's?
I mean, I have to say I don't know why the primary care doctors still refer to me, because I'm always taking people off their statins. I mean, I'm always writing a
good
very lovely, informative and documented paragraph in my intakes that I then fax to the primary care doctors.
Mm-hmm.
But anyone who complains of any kind of cognitive complaint or memory issue, or if they're a woman, or if they're diabetic, I'm like, no, you don't need the statin. You know, if they've had a heart attack in the past or they've had a stroke, there is actually data to show that, you know, it might keep you from dying from another heart attack or stroke faster than you're going to die from something else that the statin will cause. So, okay,
mm-hmm.
let's not push it too far, though. I think a dietary change would probably be preferable.
Right.
But, you know, I think I do have a lot of evidence-based medicine legs to stand on taking people off their statins. And
mm-hmm.
I've taken several people, you know, with early cognitive impairment. They're coming, and it's funny, they come to a psychiatrist with their cognitive impairment, but that happens. And I take them off their statin and they improve. So, you know, the primary care doctors, I have to say, a lot of them understand that it's just the anti-inflammatory mechanism. They understand that cholesterol isn't the entire story. They don't like statins. They have to measure a liver function test every 3 months. People always complain about them. It causes them to ache. They don't
mm-hmm.
like them. They don't take them. They have to measure all their cholesterol all the time. And so sometimes it's not as a hard of a sell as you might think. But, you know, with the CENF paper, which I have a blog on it, I think it's called, it's a blog from a couple weeks ago, something about nutrition and Alzheimer's, the dangers of insulin resistance, and there's a link, full text link there to the paper. And I think it really spells out a very scary scenario of combining hypercholesterolemia with a statin to be sort of a perfect storm to develop hyperglycemia with a statin.
Mm-hmm.
And it develops a perfect storm for causing Alzheimer's. And it's really quite scary.
Yeah, I agree completely. And, you know, not to mention all the other potential complications and risks of having low cholesterol as you age. I mean, a lot of studies we know show that your risk of death increases when your cholesterol drops below 150 and you're older than 65.
And well, yeah, I mean, Paul Gemini just did a blog on it with a great diagram from the World Health Organization data from 2005 in men, you know, showing that the lowest mortality, I think, was between 220 and 260 total cholesterol, mm-hmm. which is all high cholesterol, according to the cardiologists. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in good calories, bad calories, in women, mortality, I think, drops right up until you hit the total cholesterol of 300. And then I have a blog on low cholesterol and suicide where, you know, there's pretty strong epidemiologic evidence that cholesterol less than 160 is associated with a violent death, accident, suicide.
All kinds of fun stuff.
It's not a very pretty picture. So, you know, I don't really see the sense. It's funny because when I read Paul Gemini's blog, I looked for some... I was trying to look for some more information in women because I knew his graph was of men. And I found this Lancet article where they'd done this 20-year study and they found that the highest mortality was in the low cholesterol group. And the authors were just nonplussed. They had no idea, you know, they had all this sort of desperate discussion to say, you know, it's just a correlation. We don't know what it means. Mm-hmm. It's not the cholesterol. We're sure.
Mm-hmm. Of course not.
I mean, it's really amazing once you get wedded to the lipid hypothesis how far you will go to sort of defend it.
Absolutely. So before we move on to the next question, I just wanted to say I've had some interesting, very small anecdotal experiences so far treating early onset dementia with a ketogenic diet. And I do sort of the Gemini, you know, perfect health version of ketogenic diet where it's not as low carb as the typical ketogenic diet. It's 50 grams of carbs with using MCT oil and coconut oil as well as leucine, like 5 grams of leucine. Yeah. And I've had some unbelievably strong results using that approach. I had an 83-year-old patient who was really had lost a lot of her short-term memory and was falling down, losing motor function. Her gut was just a total mess, probably because, you know, the gut-brain connection was awry. And she went on a kind of ketogenic version of, I put her on a ketogenic version of the GAPS diet. And within 10 days, she was a different person.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's really remarkable.
It's exciting. I mean, it's obviously not enough to make any, you know, come to any conclusions about, but she's certainly happy.
And I'm happy for her. I can't always convince everybody. When they come to a conventional psychiatrist, MD, and you start talking about coconut oil, they look at you like you have three heads, and they don't always listen. You know, I haven't had a whole lot of people follow me sort of full blown into paleo. The people who have done really well, I have mm-hmm. to say. Mm-hmm. But I can't convince every family, you know, with a mild cognitive impairment or dementia to go keto, because it's not easy.
No,
you know,
it's a big commitment.
Yeah.
And she's fortunate because her whole family is on board and she has their support and they're preparing her meals. So it's a unique situation, but definitely a worthy experiment.
Definitely.
So let's go on to Jerry. He asks, are gulping down probiotics and liver really a way to treat depression? Have you had any depressed patients that got better after you gave them nutritional advice in addition to or in lieu of medication or cognitive behavioral therapy?
That's a good question. And the literature for probiotics itself is very scanty. There was a great paper published, I think, in the Journal of Affective Disorders, I could be wrong, about sort of the theoretical gut-brain axis and missing our old friends and inflammation and parasites and probiotics and all those things. And they listed a lot of the studies that have been done. Most of them have been done actually in cancer, where they would give people who are on chemotherapy who are liable to get depressed, they would give them killed mycobacteria or probiotics. And they had some differences between the placebo and the study population and how depressed they got during chemo. But that's pretty much it with respect to, you know, probiotics and depression. And I have to say, my patients who, you know, take Activia or a probiotic, no one's come back and be like, oh, my depression's cured, I'm fine. You know, that's never happened in my experience. So I don't think probiotics are the be-all, end-all for most people. It's probably, though, a part. I mean, and that's – by the time people come to see a psychiatrist, they're pretty depressed and pretty desperate. I don't know of too many people who are going to say, oh, you know, I'm feeling a little down, I'm just going to go see a psychiatrist. You know, usually they see their primary first, or they try to see somebody else, or they try to kind of get through it on their own. So I see people are pretty far along, and there are a lot of things that are out of balance, and you really have to correct all of them along the line before you can see a lot of improvement. And I think that's a lot of the problem with the literature. You try to make one intervention, and one intervention isn't what it takes. You really need to address a lot of things. And with our modern nutrient deficient diets, you're going to be low in magnesium, you're going to be low in choline, you're going to be low in the phospholipids, you're going to be low in zinc, you're going to be low in all sorts of things. And if you don't have all of those in place, you know, it's hard for your brain to work properly. So the literature is not robust. I have to say, when I've been able to convince people, many of them I've seen for quite a long time now, and the people who've been most convinced are the ones who also have autoimmune kind of fibromyalgia symptoms. So they're really suffering on all fronts. They also tend to be on the better educated side of things, or they have celiac disease.
Mm-hmm.
And those people I've been able to kind of convince to go full kind of full bore paleo. And they have had most notably a vast reduction in medication, and not necessarily completely off, mind you, but we've been able to really reduce it quite a bit. You know, also adding meditation and those kinds of things. And then they've also, I think what people have primarily described, which I think is very telling, a great decrease in fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
So someone who's tired and not motivated and fatigued all the time, you really think of an inflammation as causing this huge background of just wearing you down. You're like a wet dishcloth that's been wrung out and just thrown on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And when you put them on a paleo kind of diet, they really come to life and are more vibrant. And even if they still have some residual depression symptoms, they're doing a lot better. So that's the success that I've seen. But no, I haven't seen anybody just get a lot better with probiotics on their own.
Right. There was an interesting study. I don't know if you saw it. It was in 2010, I think, in the British Journal of Nutrition. And it was on a couple of probiotics, Lactobacillus helveticus and Bifidobacter longum. And they had the study was on rats and human healthy volunteers, and they found a significant decrease in anxiety in both the rats and the humans. I thought that was interesting, but I completely agree that it's one piece of a puzzle that can be very complex and have multiple moving parts. And it's almost never, in my experience, about a single intervention, as you pointed out, but, you know, addressing things from not only the nutritional perspective, but the, you know, the behavioral perspective as well.
Yeah, and that's a question I get quite a lot. You know, are you this nutritional perspective? It's, you know, nutrition alone. I've gone to this diet; it hasn't cured things, et cetera, et cetera. And I have to say, you know, there's the therapy. You really have to approach this with the full bore. You got to take the shotgun out and mm-hmm. and say, look, you know, you've got to look at therapy and the way you're thinking and the way that you're coping, and you've got to look at your nutrition, and you've got to look at your exercise, and you've got to look at your physical, you know, sort of medical health, and all of them really have to be in line to get your brain back in gear.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I will say too, just anecdotally, that one of the most significant and one of the quickest changes I see when people switch from a standard American diet to a paleo diet is in cognitive function and mood stability, especially if it's a higher fat paleo diet.
Yeah.
We're not necessarily talking about a clinical depression here, but just on a more, a less formally diagnostic level, people seem to experience pretty big shifts in their mood and their cognitive function.
Well, I have to say, my own personal experience shifting, it was always, I tended to be on the hypoglycemic side, so it was always very difficult for me to maintain a 20 or 30% fat diet. I would always be kind of grouchy, and I would have to eat all the time.
Mm-hmm,
and, it
was, mm-hmm.
And so just accepting the need for butter and coconut oil, and just throwing them on the eggs and just, hey, that's cool. It's been very helpful in my life. It's nice not to have to eat every 3 hours. You'd always have to have, a string cheese and an apple in your bag.
Right.
And you forgot it. Oh my God, it's 3 o'clock.
I'm going to die.
Six,
Yeah.
So it's really nice, the worst comes to worst, you grab a little square of chocolate at 4, It's much more relaxing to be on the higher fat side of things for me personally.
Yeah, I had a similar experience. I used to be pretty moody and didn't fully, thought that was maybe my personality until I started doing a really high fat diet. And then I just had, just felt really rock solid in my moods and could go for long periods without eating and not freaking out, not feeling like I was going to pass out or die if I didn't, eat food right away. And I'm sure the people around me appreciated that change too.
I'm sure they did. And I'm sure my loved ones appreciated it too.
Yeah.
Not gonna lie.
Okay, let's go on to Beverly. She says, question for Chris and Dr. Deans. I'm a nurse on an acute psychiatric unit. I've long had an interest in nutrition and mental health. We often have patients that are several years out of gastric bypass surgery who are psychotic. Is there any research being done on the long-term effects of this surgery? It seems that radically changing the gut's functioning would lead to mental health issues because of disruption of the gut-brain axis.
So I really like this question. It's one of my interests too. And I think I want to start with sort of an overall perspective on Western civilization and the idea of obesity. And when you really look as sort of a, because this is what a psychiatrist does, we think way too much about sometimes the causatives and the motivations behind everything. But when you look at the diets that have been recommended over the last 40 years, plus eventually leading to this gastric bypass surgery, I mean, the diets, they kind of, they're suck, they're hard, they're not tasty. Mm-hmm. It's like a punishment, low calorie, lots of cardboard that you have to eat. If you're diabetic, you can eat cardboard, like 5 grapes and olive oil.
Yum.
And in a fat-free skinless chicken breast that you charred in a, a George Foreman. I mean, that's,
right.
It's a horrible existence day in, day out, eating mm-hmm. that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I'm a little biased. Maybe other people enjoy that, but not I. And
hard to believe.
Then, so if you fail at that, which who wouldn't, because it's unpleasant to the extreme, and is that your entire life? If you do succeed at that, there's probably something, there's probably something unusual about you. And it's only, and that's the thing. That's how you come in Western medicine to this idea of the gastric bypass, which when you sort of look at it from the outside, it's really appalling. Let's remove, half of our upper intestine in our stomach and call it a success. I mean, it's a really appalling major surgery that you have to do. But when, from the other side of this, from the Western medicine, kind of evidence-based medicine perspective, none of the diets work. Low carb, high carb, Mediterranean, everybody gains back their weight at 5 years. You've got diabetes, that in the long term, and this is what doctors like myself see, and I think why we have a little bit of a different perspective in all these interventions. Everyone's always looking for the next supplement and the next this and the next that. But we've seen the other side where, Kurt Harris and I, where we've seen all the problems that can come from medical interventions. And, when you look at long-term diabetes, you're talking blindness and kidney failure and, it's horrible. Your feet are rotting off. And mm-hmm. uncontrolled diabetes is a very slow, very disruptive, very horrific a sort of disease to have. And so, from a doctor's perspective, if you can prevent that by lopping out someone's half of their stomach 20 years earlier, it seems like a more reasonable option from sort of the outset. And it's the only, and this is the sad state of evidence-based medicine, it's the only evidence-based medicine that works, a gastric bypass for people with, for example, with more than 100 pounds to lose, or more or who are obese with a lot of complications such as hypertension, diabetes, those kinds of things. And I mean, other things come with diabetes that we see all the time. You know, people come in with these horrible flesh-eating infections and these, you know, boils that you have to, it takes weeks and weeks of IV antibiotics and you have to surgically remove them. I mean, it's really horrific. So you can sort of see from a doctor's perspective how a gastric bypass becomes suddenly sensible when from the outside it seems crazy, you know? Mm-hmm. When you look at a gastric bypass, there are a lot of nutritional issues. I think they're better at addressing these now than they were in 1995 or whenever they sort of started doing it. And if you look at the literature, there are many, many stories of psychosis and depression and suicide after gastric bypass. Most of them are related to thiamine deficiency, they think, or a stricture that develops, like a complication of surgery where the person isn't absorbing any food at all. Mm-hmm. And some of these happen late. There was a case study I was reading of it happened 7 years after surgery. And they call it a Wernicke's encephalopathy, which is a thiamine deficiency. And they cured it with thiamine. And the person was acutely psychotic 7 years after their gastric bypass. And again, there are several stories in the literature about this. There are also stories of neurological complications from copper deficiency. I know I have several patients who've had a gastric bypass who have to go in and get B12 shots plus iron infusions, mm-hmm. IV, because they don't absorb them. And you think of a lifetime without half of your gut, which our guts as humans are already pretty short compared to other primates.
Yeah, exactly.
They're already kind of optimized for maximum efficiency. I would think there would be a lot of complications. So, you know, if someone comes to me and they say, hey, you know, doctor says I'm 80 pounds overweight, you know, they've had a lot of success with their patients doing a gastric bypass, I do tend to say, well, maybe try this Paleolithic diet first. Here's the Primal Blueprint. Here's the Perfect Health Diet. Read into it, because it seems to me that it would be a reasonable approach to try before you have half of your intestinal organs lopped out.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't agree more. And Jenny Roll at Diabetes Update actually wrote a little bit about this today. I don't know if you saw her post. She had some links to studies that linked the gastric bypass to an unexpectedly high rate of suicide.
I saw that one. Mm-hmm. That it was the suicides mostly in the first 2 years. And that's the other thing. It's once you've had a gastric bypass, you can't ever eat the same.
Right.
You know, you're... And that's such an amazing, huge change in the life of a Homo sapien. You know, you can't go to Christmas dinner and have, you know, all the turkey you want. You can't, you know, it's never going to be the same. And that's a huge change. They've required now, for all gastric bypass, you're required to have a psychiatric evaluation before you have it done. And they're also, I think, better at repleting the nutrition. So I think there are fewer complications now than there used to be. But I don't know about 10 years, 12 years out. What do you do 12 years without enough copper? 12 years without quite enough thiamine? I mean, I don't think we really have the data on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's assuming that... you know, the medical system stays completely intact the way it is, and then you become completely dependent on it, and that would be pretty scary to me. I mean, I would consider just about any other option before I did that.
Well, sure. I mean, yeah, you have to have a B12 shot or you're eventually going to die.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty scary, right?
Yep.
While from the Western medicine perspective, there is a place for a gastric bypass, especially compared to the conventional treatments, you know, when you really compare it to an evolutionary medicine perspective, it falls short in every mm-hmm. kind of way.
Yeah.
And there was one more thing I wanted to mention. They did do a study 4 years out of depression and gastric bypass. And for the majority of the people, the depression that they'd had when they were severely obese and very sick was decreased after 4 years. So I did want to mention that because mm-hmm. it's fair to kind of mention both sides.
Sure.
But that's 4 years, you know, who knows about 10, 12, et cetera.
Right, yeah. Okay, this is from, I think, Milad. He asks, he or she asks, can gluten intolerance induce mental and bipolar disorders? I know someone who has a GI tract manifestation of gluten intolerance, and this person has a sister who almost always had bipolar disorder, made worse perhaps by medication. What do you think about this? Thanks a lot.
Well, I really do, and I think like every other paleo blogger, wheat is kind of our nemesis because we have a lot of suspicions and a lot of smoke at the fire, but we can't quite, you know, say there's the gun, you know. And there are a lot of Kurt Dohan and Faith Dickerson are two researchers who've done a lot of research into gluten and schizophrenia and gluten and bipolar disorder, and they found a lot of very mysterious things that, for example, on an inpatient unit in the 60s, they put one inpatient unit on a gluten-free diet and the other inpatient unit on their regular diet. And lo and behold, the people on the gluten-free unit were released, you know, twice as fast. They were healthier and ready to go back to, into the community mm-hmm. as the people on the regular hospital diet. And what Faith Dickerson has found is that in the urine of schizophrenic people, there are a lot of weird gluten-derived proteins. Some of these are very different from the ones that you will find in celiac disease, and they're very different from what you would find in people who don't have schizophrenia. What the heck are they doing there? Is it the gluten itself that's the problem? Is it the wheat, or is it that people with schizophrenia have leaky guts? Is it an inflammation issue? I mean, nobody really knows. It's just the finding. There aren't a whole lot of, let's just say the literature is not robust. However, I have heard sort of off the record and in comments and kind of looking around the internet that many people, when they drop gluten, their mood swings get better, their bipolar disorder gets better, they can go off meds, they can do... So, you know, it's not something that people always buy from me when I tell them, but people who go gluten-free... there is a chance that their mood disorder might get better mm-hmm. from the case studies that I've heard. And to me, I don't see why you wouldn't try it.
Exactly. There's no downside. We don't require wheat for our survival. So certainly eliminating it for a period of time, it's hard to argue against that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of distress about, oh, we're eliminating wheat. You know, and I don't quite get it. You know, there's this... If you're trying to do a gluten-free, casein-free diet for kids with autism, for example, there's all these warnings, you know, they're going to get nutrient deficient, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm sort of, you know, I don't see it. I do eat wheat every now and again. I have pizza.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
80-20 rule, right?
But it's not that often, and it's not a big deal for me. I know people... There are people who love bread. They can't imagine life without bread. And I've had some discussions where they're just, they talk about bread. It's like people talking about their heroin.
Yeah, exactly.
They're like, fluffiness of it, the smell of it. Is it leading up to it, and I break open the bread, and the little kernel split open, and I smell it, and then I put butter on, you know, of course, or margarine or whatever horrific thing.
Yeah, right. Let's hope not.
But that's, you know, I could really care less if I didn't eat bread. So it's interesting the different experiences that people have, but and that could be because of the opiate issue with bread.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have actually some success with treating night binging on bread with an opiate blocker called naltrexone.
Mm-hmm.
Which
are you using the lower dose?
No, I've used the 50 milligrams. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Which is what we use for opiate dependence.
Right.
So that's kind of what I'm comfortable
Bring
with.
Bring out the big guns.
Right. And I think the lowest pill you can get is 50 milligrams, at least prescription. So
you can get it compounded, actually. But okay. Yeah, you can't. You can't. Yeah, it's not at your corner. It's not at your corner. It's not at your corner. Not at your corner Walgreens, let's say.
The apothecary will compound it for you.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I've certainly, and like you said, when you look at Rob Wolf's, like, or Mark Sisson's site and all the testimonials there, and certainly in my patient population, I've had a lot of pretty dramatic improvements with people just removing gluten from their diet, like way more than they could have ever predicted or imagined.
Yeah, and I've had people approach me privately, people who are really sort of highfalutin in the paleo movement, and they're talking about family members or themselves, and they said, you know, I was really kind of off the wall before. I had a lot of mood swings, a lot of depression, and when I dropped gluten, all of that changed. And I think that's an important finding, and we need to pay attention to that. And it's a painless finding in the overall history of the world. You know, dropping gluten is not the end of the world, and I think the nutritional sort of USDA and all that kind of thing need to catch up with that and figure that out, because I think it could be tremendously helpful for a lot of people for a lot of different health conditions.
Absolutely.
Autoimmune and, and mental health and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Especially in kids, you know, because to start medicating kids with behavioral disorders when they're 5, 4, 5, 6 years old without trying something like this just strikes me as crazy.
Yeah, it's very disturbing. I'm not a child psychiatrist, and there's not a great deal of data for them. I feel for the child psychiatrist because the data is poor, and they're dealing with very difficult situations. And you have a kid with ADD, really bad ADD, who's 6, for example, and he's already, you know, making everybody in his class angry. So, you know, because he's always in their face or he's running around and disrupting everything, so he doesn't have friends. And he, you know, he's at higher risk for divorce, car accidents, suicide, depression. And so, again, this medical model comes in and says, treat early, treat aggressively. And there's not the evidence for, you know, until recently, the evidence for dietary interventions was pretty scanty. So you can see from this sort of Western medicine perspective, aggressively treating, you know, a preschooler seems like the right thing, because you don't want them to start to develop all these problems and then have a higher risk of suicide. I mean, as people with ADHD, boys with ADD, or something like 21% of them in this one study had committed a felony by the age of 20.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was bad.
Yeah, it's a real problem. Mm-hmm.
So we think about being in jail the rest of your life versus the risk of being on Ritalin from the time you're 10. Well, being in jail is probably worse. But when you put that aside and think from a very large perspective and think, okay, let's try an evolutionary diet, getting them out, a different approach, more flexible approach, it seems like the more flexible dietary approach is a very obvious way to address it first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And again, I mean, the whole GAPS approach, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, this was created by a doctor from Russia who now lives in the UK. Her name's Natasha Campbell McBride. And she had I think her son was born, developed autism. And she researched the treatments that were available at that time. This was, I think her son's like 18 or 20 now. So this was quite a while back. And she developed this hypothesis that autism and other behavioral disorders had some link to gut health. And so the GAPS diet, you know, which she developed or based on the specific carbohydrate diet, removed not only gluten but all grains and all disaccharides and polysaccharides. And if you go on like the Yahoo group for the GAPS diet, you will see reports from parents all over the world that are having huge, huge success with this approach, with kids with everything from ADHD to autism to schizophrenia to depression, anxiety, you know, and pretty much any disorder. And again, I mean, that's not cold, hard, double-blind, placebo-controlled evidence, but for these parents, and you know, a lot of parents that I work with, when they consider what the alternatives are, it doesn't make sense not to at least give it, you know, a 30-day trial. I mean, it's...
Well, I agree 100%, and I should probably bring up here really the best of any sort of paleo intervention for any psychiatric disorder. The best evidence is actually in ADHD, in what was called the INCA trial in Belgium, I think in February of 2011. They took 100 kids, and they put 50 of them, the whole idea was to put them on an anti-inflammatory, anti-allergenic diet, but they ended up putting them on, all they could eat was rice, meat, vegetables, water, and pears. And they could have small amounts, if they tolerated it, of wheat, potatoes, and other fruits. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, they were stuck with those five primary things, and they put them on this diet for 9 weeks, these 50 kids. And all the kids had been diagnosed fairly rigorously with ADHD, and their behavior and attention improved quite a bit after the 9 weeks. Then they switched over. They had 50 kids on a control kind of Belgian USDA diet, and they switched the control kids over to the intervention diet, and they switched the intervention kids over to the control diet. And there were more complications to what they did, because they tested them for IgG allergens, which is probably useless, as you and I agree, I think. But they tested them so they would introduce the different allergens, and it made absolutely no difference in their behavior. It was really just going from this very restricted anti-allergenic, what many of us would call a sort of a very paleo-friendly diet, to a regular old USDA sort of Belgian diet that caused their symptoms to come back. So, right. I mean, 60% reduction is tremendous.
Especially considering there are no side effects or risks associated with that treatment.
Right. Other than, you know, I have two little kids, and when they want candy, I mean, it can be very destructive.
I guess that is a little bit risky, too, when you got kids flailing around, freaking out.
And when you have a severely autistic kid, you can't judge. I mean, you have to pick your battles. Yeah. And some of them are very restricted in what they will eat. And from one side, you have to say, gosh, you have to try this. Why wouldn't you? From the other side, they're saying, you know, my kid bangs his head. You know, he has to be restrained in 4-point restraints if we don't give him his, you know, Fruit Loops or whatever it is. And when you kind of look at it from that approach, you have to really sort of suspend judgment. People will have to do what they have to do, and you have to meet them where they are. But from a sort of general population perspective, I agree, we have to try these dietary interventions that are inexpensive and not harmful before we, you know, try all of these other pharmacologic or other sort of useless interventions that don't work.
Okay, let's do one short question, and then we'll finish up with a more meta question, which I think will be a nice way to finish. So the short one is from Mind Flayer, interesting handle there. Can you please discuss the role that iron deficiency anemia has on psychiatric issues?
Well, that's pretty straightforward, because when we make our neurotransmitters, we have to have iron. You know, if you're making serotonin, if you're making dopamine, if you're making norepinephrine, if you're making acetylcholine, all of these are neurotransmitters that affect the communication in the brain. And if you do not have iron as a cofactor for the enzymes that turn the protein that we eat into these different neurotransmitters, you're not going to make them. So I've had patients who, when they get iron deficient, become extremely moody, extremely tired, extremely depressed. They can't sleep. The minute you replete the iron, they do better. Also, with low iron or low ferritin, you're much more likely to have sleep disorders, restless legs. Mm-hmm. Especially if you don't have good sleep, you are not going to have good mental health. All of the same areas of the brain, the same neurotransmitters, are involved with good mental health as with good sleep. So if you do not have iron, it's very difficult to have good mental health. So it's pretty straightforward. You need to have iron. And if you have iron deficiency anemia, something's going wrong. You know, so you're not absorbing it. Mm-hmm. You're bleeding from somewhere. You know, just because you're a woman and you have a period does not mean you should have iron deficiency anemia.
Right.
That's actually one of the complications of a couple of my patients who've had a gastric bypass. You know, they get to severe iron deficiency. They come in, their eyes are sunken, their skin is gray. And I'm like, when's the last time you went in for an iron infusion? Oh, I forgot to do it, you know?
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's been like 5 months. No one's checked it.
Like,
uh-oh. Get out of here. You don't need me.
Yeah, yeah.
You need some iron.
It's really amazing to see what happens when you give someone who's iron deficient iron. It's like the lights turn on.
Yeah. Well, it's oxygen. You know, your hemoglobin needs iron to carry oxygen. So
and the brain needs oxygen.
It's like you're on top of Everest down at sea level without the adaptation.
Suffocating. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so last question from Jackie. I'm interested in what kind of interface you see between biology and each individual's thoughts, feelings, and actions. To clarify, thoughts, feelings, and actions are able to influence biology. E.g., the use of dialectic behavioral therapy can influence neural connections in the healing of complex PTSD personality disorder. Conversely, nutrition can influence thoughts, feelings, and actions. Reducing inflammation helps with the lived experience of depression. While I definitely see paleo non-toxic nutrition as one strand of future mental health care, it's not the only strand. I get a bit worried about privileging biology in such a complex area, as I don't see it as being very far removed from the old style medical model, just substituting diet for meds.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I agree with her. Because a lot of times I'll get those questions, oh, what supplement do you use for PTSD? What supplement do you use for this?
And
sort of the overall meta answer is there is no supplement. You know, you create a resilient brain by making a resilient human being with a loving environment from birth. And you know, micronutrient and plenty of fat and plenty of magnesium and plenty of everything they need from birth, and they don't have any trauma. And then you get this sort of glorious, resilient human being, but who's also trained to kind of meet adversity when it comes. And that's this sort of ultimate human being, I suppose, who wouldn't have any mental health problems, you know, whatever they faced. That's not always what we're given. So it's always a combination of proper nutrition. You know, if you've had traumas in your past, if you need some help in sorting out how you think about things, getting the right therapist. The interesting thing about therapy is when you, there's been a lot more data on, for example, cognitive behavioral therapy for certain things, DBT for other things. But when you really compare therapy to therapy, they're all about the same.
Mm-hmm.
They're all fairly equivalent, actually, to medication, though the benefits of therapy can last a lot longer than the benefits of medication. But it's all, you know, when you you look at the treatments, it's about 60% effective across the board. So finding the right therapy, finding the right way of thinking about things, the right way of coping things that works for your environment, for your life, it's all exceedingly important. And the reason that I focus, to be perfectly honest, the reason that I focus on the nutrition element is because you focus on it, Chris, but there aren't a whole lot of other psychiatrists or people in the mental health field who focus on things in the way that I would like to see it focused on, in a very evidence-based, very skeptical kind of approached.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, there are plenty of fabulous blogs on psychotherapy, on psychiatry. You go into Psychology Today, where I have a blog, and there are 100 blogs there that address all of these other issues. I don't address it that much in my blog, but it doesn't mean that I don't think it's very important. And meditation, mindfulness, these approaches to life of serenity, I think are extraordinarily helpful. They're not always taught when you're grown up in sort of a Western society, but I've spent some time teaching mindfulness-based stress reduction and how to breathe and how to meditate, and it's extraordinarily helpful. I've had patients who were on tons of medication and couldn't leave the house. They could only leave the house to come see me or their therapist, because they knew that if they had a panic attack in our waiting room, that, you know, I'm a psychiatrist, I would probably know what to do.
Yeah.
but they couldn't go to the grocery store, they couldn't go to work, they couldn't go to their kids' graduation, they couldn't go anywhere. And starting a meditation program, after a time, they're completely cured. Mm-hmm. They could go back to work, they could go out, they could go shopping, they could go to the grocery store, they could come see me. Over time, we reduced all their medications to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So things like meditation can be extraordinarily powerful. So I don't want to ignore all these things. I don't write about them mostly because other people would do a much better job
mm-hmm. yeah.
of writing about them.
Yeah. So for people who are interested in learning more about mindfulness practice, you can check out Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction. It's Jon Kabat-Zinn's work. He has a really amazing clinic at the University of Massachusetts, been doing a lot of good research for 20 years.
He's a great book. I'm blanking on the name right now. I'm sorry. I interrupted because I thought I would remember the name.
His book?
It's called...
Full Catastrophe Living?
Full Catastrophe Living. Yep. Yeah, I have that book. It's a great book.
It's a great one. Yeah, and then there's...
MBSR is what I was a teacher of for a while.
Right, so. I figured that's what you were talking about.
Yeah.
And then there's... you can go... Actually, he sells CDs, which have recordings of the body scan and the guided yoga and guided meditation at mindfulnesstapes.com. They're only like $30 for a set, I think. I use them a lot in my practice. I have a lot of success with them. I've done the training myself as well, and it's a big part of my keeping myself healthy. Jackie's question too just reminds me of how important it is to approach this individually, not only physiological health, but mental health, of course. And one of the reasons I wrote the 9 Steps series was because I see a lot of people in the paleo primal world just obsessively focusing on nutrition, almost at the exclusion of all else. So, you know, they're putting all of their energy into squeezing out the last 1 or 2% of benefit they're going to get from making dietary changes or, you know, taking this supplement or that supplement. And meanwhile, they're not sleeping, they're not having any fun or enjoying life.
People worry so much about, you know, can I eat this banana?
Right.
And, you know, just eat the banana. You're going to be okay.
Eat the banana, enjoy it while you're eating it, and, you know, go outside. Or, like, get a massage or get some exercise or whatever it is. Like, but there's a lot of things that go into what makes us a healthy human being, as you pointed out. And so it's not ever easy to answer the question, like, what supplement should I take or what should I do? Because it always, we don't live in a vacuum. We live in a rich context of work and relationship and, you know, relationship with others, relationship to ourselves, our nutritional status, and all of these things, you know, play a really significant, important role. So just a reminder of how unique we are as individuals and how much that needs to be considered when we're asking and answering, trying to answer any of these questions.
Yep. Hallelujah.
Hallelujah. So, Emily, why don't you tell my listeners where they can find out more about you, your blog address, and so they can come check you out if they haven't already heard of you.
Well, my sort of crazy off-the-cuff first draft blog is at evolutionarypsychiatry.blogspot.com. It's one of the blogger blogs. And then I have a more refined kind of second draft blog that I get paid for. So click over there, please, at Psychology Today. Mm-hmm. Which you go over to you Google Psychology Today and go to their blogs and search for evolutionary psychiatry and find my blog there. And that has sort of updated and more consolidated versions of my over 200 articles at my evolutionarypsychiatry.blogspot.com blog.
Which are all fantastic, and I highly encourage you to read them. Emily's become one of my favorite bloggers, and we're super excited to have you on the show today, and we hope you can come back sometime soon.
Well, I was really excited to be on this show. I mean, it's a pretty elite group who gets to be on the Healthy Skeptics. It was very exciting to be a member of that group.
We're flattered you came. And just, you all probably noticed we're missing my wingman, Danny, today. He couldn't be here. He was really sad that he couldn't make it because he was excited to interview Emily, but hopefully he'll be back with us next time. And my blog, of course, is thehealthyskeptic.org. And thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.